From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You know, we can't seem to get Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Reagan to come on our show, but we can get Jim Morris to be them for us. On today's Fresh Air, spoofing the president with political satirist and impressionist Jim Morris. Also today, a special treat for those of you who love to write disapproving letters about my pronunciation. We'll talk with Brian Sietsema, pronunciation editor of the new 10th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. He monitors Fresh Air and takes notes on the pronunciations he hears from me and my guests. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers the language of the business world, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album of singer Juliana Ray. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. More than 150 Haitian refugees testing positive for the AIDS virus have been ordered released from a U.S. naval base in Cuba. Mondalit Del Barco of member station WNYC reports that a federal judge blasted the government's handling of the case.
U.S. District Judge Sterling Johnson called the 158 refugees at Guantanamo Bay victims of outrageous, callous, and reprehensible behavior by the Bush and Clinton administrations. Because of a U.S. immigration policy banning the entry of HIV-positive immigrants, the refugees have been held for more than 18 months in the barbed wire camp. Johnson's ruling called for their immediate release. The camp reportedly could be closed in the next few weeks if the federal government doesn't appeal the decision that had refugees at Guantanamo dancing and cheering. Before this decision, Judge Johnson ordered the government to release more than 50 Haitians with full-blown AIDS into the U.S. for treatment. Thousands of other Haitians have entered the country on political asylum requests since the ousting of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. For National Public Radio, I'm Mondalit Del Barco in New York.
Amnesty International said today that American foreign aid is going to countries that abuse human rights and may even contribute to rights violations. The U.S. branch of the International Human Rights Group said that the United States contributes military aid to countries such as Israel and Egypt, where human rights violations are continuing. There's a federal law that bans aid to countries where consistent and gross human rights abuses occur. Amnesty International says the law has never been applied. The State Department had no official comment. President Clinton is working with Senate leaders to reconfigure his controversial energy tax. NPR's Mara Liasson has the story.
The president originally proposed a BTU tax, a tax based on the energy content of fuel measured in BTUs, or British thermal units. But now, as he struggles to find enough support for his program in the Senate, where many oil and farm state senators oppose a BTU tax, he's signaling his willingness to compromise. Now the White House says all the president wants is a broad-based energy tax. According to Press Secretary Dee Dee Myers, the White House is willing to consider changes in the size of the tax, possibly reducing it by one-third, but that the White House is leaving the question of how the tax is structured and what it's called to the Senate. The tax the president proposed would raise about $70 billion over 5 years. Republicans, who attended a bipartisan meeting with the president today, said they thought the administration is now looking at a tax based on the value of fuel at different points in the production process, rather than a tax based on heat content. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 3,511. This is NPR News. The Air Force said today it will investigate charges that a two-star general made contemptuous remarks about President Clinton. The Washington Post reported today that Major General Harold Campbell described the president as a draft-dodging, pot-smoking, womanizing commander-in-chief. The comments allegedly came in a speech Campbell made at an Air Force banquet in the Netherlands. The general could face a court-martial if the charges are found to be true. German police in Dusseldorf say that arson caused the fire early today at an apartment house occupied by Turkish immigrants. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The fire was started by assailants who spread gasoline in the house, according to local police. 14 people were hospitalized after suffering from smoke inhalation. In Frankfurt, Turkish inhabitants of an apartment house escaped injury after paper doused with turpentine was set on fire overnight in the stairwell of the building. In Hamburg, a Turkish restaurant was damaged by an arson attack, and in two other cities, a Turkish and a Greek restaurant were firebombed. No one was injured. In a television interview, Chancellor Helmut Kohl defended his absence from the memorial service last week for five Turkish victims of an arson attack in Solingen, claiming his attendance would have provoked demonstrators. Kohl blamed the renewed surge in right-wing violence on resentment of the hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers who have come to Germany the past few years. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Bergen, Frankfurt.
Election officials in Los Angeles say that only about 35% of registered voters are expected to turn out for today's mayoral contest between Michael Wu and Richard Reardon. Some voters have expressed disgust that the race degenerated into personal attacks on the part of both candidates. Although the race is officially nonpartisan, Reardon has strong Republican backing, while Wu has the official endorsement of the state Democratic Party. The winner in today's race will replace five-term Mayor Tom Bradley, who's retiring. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Clinton is probably in no laughing mood right now, but my guest Jim Morris isn't going to let that stop him from lampooning the president. Morris is a political satirist and impressionist who started his career at about the same time President Reagan took office. Morris worked up such a convincing portrayal of Reagan, he took his act to Washington and held mock press conferences. When Reagan left office, Morris went on to become George Bush. Now he's doing Bill Clinton. He's performed at the White House and Washington correspondence dinners, not to mention comedy clubs around the country. I asked Jim Morris to be Bill Clinton for us and tell us what he's been most unprepared for as president.
I just have to say that I wasn't prepared for the onslaught of the type of scrutiny that I'd be coming under as president of the United States. I believe that George Stephanopoulos did a wonderful job, but we needed to make a change there. Now, there's been speculation that I've somehow banished George or sent him away, but he's actually nearby. He's taken over as assistant manager, trainee at the McDonald's here in Washington, D.C., so I see him two, three, even four times a day. He can continue to serve this administration, albeit in a different capacity. A question may be raised by you or somebody else in the press, did I use my influence to get him that job? Well, let me just say, I wouldn't be surprised if the president doesn't get a few extra French fries here and there. God bless you for asking that. But I'm enjoying my time here in the Oval Office.
Was the $200 haircut worth the money, and would you recommend the stylist to other men?
Let me just say, I've learned to develop a sense of humor about things like that. For instance, I just flew in from L.A., and boy, is my hair short. You know, jokes like that. And so's my temper. I can't believe people and you, like you in the press would, you know, still quiz me on something like that. You know, it's been an awful hardship on me since Floyd the Barber moved to Mount Pilot. I don't know what else to tell you.
Now, I understand we're privileged to have former President George Bush in the room as well. President Bush, how do you think President Clinton is doing?
How do I think President Clinton's doing? Well, certainly not going to, you're not going to hear me, no sour grapes here, no bitterness here. You're not going to hear me call my opponent in the last campaign there a failed, philandering, whoremongering, hillbilly, saxophone-sucking former governor of a small southern state. You're not going to hear it from me. I support him. My sleeves are rolled up. My hand is extended to him. But my middle finger's starting to twitch, I tell you that. But I think, can I be candid with you?
Go ahead.
I think what we're going to see is nothing more than Clinton economics. I call it Elvis economics, a reckless policy of excessive spending that causes the government to get fatter and fatter until one day the economy just falls off the toilet and dies. That's Elvis economics. I don't know what else to tell you. You know, but there's no bitterness here. I felt I deserved to be reelected. We had a wonderful first term. Just look at the wreckage. Record.
Now, I think you had it right the first time, George.
Hey, nobody's talking to you. I'm very happy down in Houston there with Barbara. We're in the grandkid business. We're shipping them over the border in vans. Just kidding.
Now, I think that really points up his attitude to...
Now, hold on. Now, you remember the convention in Houston when my grandson George P. stood up there and shouted, Viva Bush? Remember that? Of
course I do. Actually, I didn't watch it, but what's your point?
Well, Viva is Spanish for paper towel. And I think what George P. was trying to say was that this campaign was going to be the quicker picker-upper, but it didn't work out that way. But I'll tell you this, I was the one who was tested. I deserved to be reelected. I was the one who'd been through the fire. I was the one who'd been through the desert on a horse with no name.
Listen to this guy over here, and I'm sure it feels good to be out of the rain, too.
Jim Morris, I'm going to call on you. What's it been like for you to have a new president in the White House who you really have to get down, both the voice, the manner, but you also have to get down their take on things and have your take on their take?
Right. It's always a work in progress. I mean, I'm even adding layers to Reagan's, I saw him at the Kings games there in L.A. On TV. I saw him sitting there with Nancy, and he looked a little, so that even that gives me more information. What? No. Nancy, what's going on here? What? Look at the hockey puck. Oh, that's right. We're at a Don Rickles show. Where's the hockey puck? No. See, so one day I'll do a one-man show with all these guys together. I'll look back. But with Bill Clinton, here's a guy who speaks in complete sentences, and that makes it more difficult than doing George Bush. Who can start to say something of that particular nature? No, we've got problems over there. And furthermore, I know that we did whatever Bosnia-Herzegovina got a DeVita. It was more fun doing Bush because we all knew about his quirks and eccentricities. And with Clinton, it takes the audience more time to get to know the guy. I mean, presidents tend to get funnier over time, whether it's a crisis or the pressures of the job. In the past few months, there's been a lot to laugh at with Clinton.
Do you change your material depending on whether you're performing for a Democratic or Republican audience?
No, I don't. I remember when I performed for President Bush on a few occasions, I was very nervous, but not, because I was performing for the president. It was more like I was nervous about whether I was going to pull any punches and not go at him with, go for the jugular. And I said, well, what the hell, you only go around once. And I hit him with the hardest hitting material I had, and it was a success. That's what I do. I don't need to water it down for anybody, and certainly not with Clinton. I try not to take the cheap shots, A cheap shot, here's an example of a cheap shot.
Yeah.
On the Supreme Court nominee, we'll probably be hearing about, by the end of the week. Here's a joke that I probably shouldn't do and won't, except for you and your listeners.
Lucky us. Go ahead.
In terms of a nominee for Supreme Court, there are many ways that this administration could go. One, we could go through a lengthy and time-consuming search for someone who represents the very best ideals of justice and fairness and would bring an experienced sense of fairness to the Supreme Court. Or we could just put another chick in there, someone for Sandy O'Connor to swap recipes with. See, there's an example of a sexist joke.
This is one you're not going to tell, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, might pepper the act with a couple of references, but that's about it, because it's too easy, it's too cheap. It's like Jimmy Carter with the smile or with the rabbit or Jerry Ford stumbling down the stairs. I mean, once you do the joke, then what? So I'm fascinated by the news and politicians and why people would even get into a life like that. And so I try to do what an editorial cartoonist might do, and that is take the news of the day and put a caption, on the bottom of the... I'm like a walking, talking political cartoon.
So what did you look for in Clinton's voice when you started doing him?
Raspy, real raspy. I didn't know how I was going to be able to do him.
How did you do it? You didn't have to, hurt your voice to do it, did you?
No. You see, I worry a lot about how I'm going to do a voice, but I should know by now that I should just relax and, do all this passive, watching on videotape and watching their speeches. And there's only so much of these guys I can take, so that can become grueling after a while. And then eventually something happens where from the inside out, I sort of understand the character more. And
I've captured the essence, you know. I mean, it comes from the inside. I don't have to worry about how to do the voice. I can just feel the character, and it'll happen. And, you know, after a while, I'm not quite at that point right now. After a while, I've built up enough of a vocabulary, enough topics, you know, I know how the president feels about this issue and that issue and that issue, where I can stand up in front of an audience and just take questions, because that's what I like to do with my presidents. I did it with Reagan, did it with Bush, where I hold a press conference where people can come in and ask questions, and it's very cathartic for them and for me, because, you know, who most of us never get to question the president, and it takes on a certain theatricality, you know. I mean, people forget that I'm just an actor playing the president, and so sometimes it can get really frightening. People yelling at me, you know, what are you going to do about AIDS? And I give some evasive answer, and then they yell back, and they're really serious. They forget, and then we all have that moment where we sort of laugh and realize, oh wow, it got out of hand there.
You're lucky you can go home at night and not take responsibility for this.
Yeah, I don't have the responsibility to run the country.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is political satirist Jim Morris. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Political satirist Jim Morris is my guest. How did you start to realize that you could do impressions of other people?
Well, I was probably around the dinner table when I was a kid, of course. My uncles and my aunts, and I remember sitting across from my Uncle Morty, and
could you pass the matzo balls already? I'm sitting here waiting for the matzo balls. Look at the kid there. He's sitting there looking at me. What's he doing?
He's mimicking you already. Would you ignore him?
What?
Ignore him. He's mimicking you.
He's mimicking me? Young man, why are you talking like that?
I just looked at him. I said, I don't know. Why are you talking like that? You know, it was fascinating to me. So it...
Now, who had a... Who takes it better, presidents or uncles, when you do them?
Well, I didn't get too much encouragement when I was a kid. you know, the teachers in school, there were always a few who did encourage me. Well, I remember one teacher who allowed me 5 minutes of class time every day, if I wanted it, to stand up at the very beginning of the class and get it out of my system, and everybody, you know, because otherwise I'd be a disruptive, that was bargaining. I mean, that was quite a bargain. I got 5 minutes at the top of the class. I don't know whether it was once a week or every day, to get it out of my system and imitate all the other teachers, and he'd stand in the back and just really dig it, you know. It was and the principal of the school. One time I actually went on the, because I was president of my class, I actually in my senior year went on the public address system. I had access to it, you see, and I knew how to get through the whole complex there, and I went on as the principal and dismissed the whole school early.
Did they go?
Well, let's put it this way. Everybody else left a lot earlier than I did that day.
Now, what would you do with your 5 minutes in front of the class?
Well, I would imitate the other teachers and improvise and make things up and have teachers talking to each other, and really, I didn't get dirty or anything like that, but, you know, I used to do these little sketches where the French teacher would arrive on a motorcycle and I'd make the sound effects, and then, you know, I can't remember most of it.
Jim, can you tell us how you got down the voice of President Bush?
Well, I suppose it was a cross between John Wayne and Mr. Rogers and Liberace. Yeah, it was.
The Liberace part makes it really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you start out with this John Wayne type thing, and who else did I mention? Mr. Rogers? John Wayne. And you're special. Do you know that? And then the real, you know, John Wayne and Liberace and Mr. Rogers. You know, my fellow Americans, you are special. You know that? You know, it's sort of like that. But
Bush, just watching him was enough for me. I mean, the broken syntax and,
we have a new world order out there. There's a new breeze blowing, and we're breaking new wind, ground. What was I saying?
What about Ronald Reagan? What did you look for in his voice and in his manner of speaking?
Oh, these are difficult questions. It's so hard to say. I mean, it's like you can't really put your finger on it. It's almost like I can't describe how I get a voice, especially someone like Reagan. Grandfatherly, a little vacant and lost, and no, I cannot describe it. It's because that's not what I start with. It's just.
What do you start with?
I start with the watching him and a feeling of his attitudes. Basically, it's attitudes and emotions. That's what really makes it fly. Reagan's emotions when he's trying to charm a group or a person or the camera, especially. He's learned a lot, you know, over his career and how to do that with the eyebrows arched and the lips perched and the glint in his eye and
you know, that little chuckle there and the head bobbing around. And
so you're wondering what he's going to say, and you know that he likes you, and he's a very endearing guy. You're waiting to hear what he has to say. And then when he talks about patriotic virtue and all that, and you're thinking, me? He's talking to me. You are an American hero. Your deeds have kindled the flame that burns deep in our souls and provides endless inspiration to all those that you touch. Me? In my day-to-day life? Yes, you. You've carried the torch and held it high for all to see, for all who yearn to see our shores from sea to... And you want to help him out. It's a shining sea, Mr. President. Right,
over there. For all you have done and... all you continue to do, well, for all you do, this budge for you. I don't know. I just get the script. I stand on my mark and I say, what's my motivation? To please Nancy, that's it.
Now, how do you feel when you see Dana Carvey doing Bush or Phil Hartman doing Clinton? Are you critical of their impersonations?
Well, I it's hard for me not to be critical. But I keep it to myself. I mean, I say, oh, yeah, they get the essence of his thing there, and they miss there. Everything is true. I mean, if they do their homework and they have their rendition, then that is as true as what I present. But the real answer is I can't watch them because it throws me off. I have to go right to the source. If I watch Hartman do his thing, then mine is going to be a little slanted or colored. It gets more difficult when you consider that so many millions more people see and identify with their impressions of the president than mine. So a lot of times people will think that I'm going to come out with a, wouldn't be prudent, wouldn't be, right, and I don't do that in my act, but I'm not offended when they say, oh, you're the guy who does, wouldn't be prudent, right? No, not right. But I can understand. I mean, they have a lot more exposure than I do. But for Clinton, I just have to go right to the source. And I, you know, we're talking about change, a change for new ideas, a change for new ideas and a new generation of leadership and a break from the past and the old ideas and the old generation of leadership for a change into the new generation of leadership and new ideas. What did you say? I don't know, but it sounded pretty good, I think.
Political satirist Jim Morris. This Friday, he performs at Symphony Space in New York as part of the Toyota Comedy Festival. June 17th, he opens at Catch a Rising Star in Boston. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has observed a new style of communication in the business world, something that has raised the art of corporate speak to a new level.
I see these books all the time in the business racks of airport bookstores. They're sort of self-help books for managers. They have titles like The Fifth Paradigm or The One-Minute Toady or Elbow Your Way to Excellence. Their authors are consultants or business school professors with aspirations to becoming the Robert Fulghams and Deborah Tannens of the hiring and firing classes. What's most intriguing about these books isn't what they say, though, but how they look. They're so busy. The chapters are only 2 or 3 pages long, and there's a subheading on just about every paragraph. They're full of lists, particularly lists where the items are introduced by those little black spots called bullets. In fact, the ideal paragraph consists of nothing but a subheading and a bullet list. 6 traits of the visionary executive, 11 steps for implementing cultural change. And they have diagrams, lots of diagrams, not so much for quantitative information as for emphasizing important concepts. When you're writing one of these books, you don't want to make your key points with full sentences like, the more you know, the more you control what's going on around you. What you do instead is you print the word knowledge in 24-point boldface in a box on the left side of the page, and then you run an arrow from that box to another box on the right that contains the word empowerment. Now, a reader who's accustomed to more traditional forms of prose exposition is apt to find this a fairly inefficient way of getting the point across. A picture like this is only worth about 11 words, after all, and it takes up half a page. But then, you really don't want to think of these as books at all. What they are is the transcriptions of slide talks. As you look at them, in fact, you can tell right off they weren't written on word processing programs. They're put together on presentation software like More or Persuasion or PowerPoint. These are the programs that everybody's got running on their laptops in the forward cabin while the folks back in steerage are waiting for the attendants to pick up their dinner trays. They enable you to go from a topic outline to a finished set of 35-millimeter slides without ever once passing through a paragraph of connected prose. They come with every size and shape of text box and border, and a selection of bullets and arrows big enough to reenact the Battle of the Little Bighorn 1,000 times over. Now, it's fair to dismiss the management self-help books as a marginal literary form, but the slide presentation is a genre that we ignore at our peril. Thanks in part to all this software, it's become the most essential form of communication in the modern corporation. No company holds a sales meeting or adopts a new marketing strategy or reorganization plan before the slide carousels have gone through a couple of hundred revolutions. It's the closest thing there is in American life to a pure discourse of power. I hear people say that business people don't trust language, but that's far from the truth. Corporate managers have an almost childlike faith in the incantatory powers of words to make things happen. What makes them uneasy is narrative and exposition. I once watched one of these B-school gurus doing a presentation to an audience of a couple of hundred managers in a darkened hall. He walked back and forth across the stage, manipulating a remote control slide changer in one hand, a laser pointer in the other. He flashed up a slide with a single word dialogue written in a text box alongside a two-headed arrow. Dialogue, he said, from the Greek dia, across, and logos, meaning meaning. Dialogue is where the meaning comes across. The people in the audience nodded. I looked at the slide carousel and at the screen, and I thought of the Tibetan Buddhists and their mantras. They write them on slips of paper and spin them in prayer wheels. They print them on flags and hang them outside their houses so that a benevolent wind can pick up the words and brush them against every living thing it touches. And then I thought, so it isn't the end of language after all, just the end of syntax. Well, that's business.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Those Fresh Air listeners who love to criticize my pronunciation had better keep listening. Coming up, we'll talk with Brian Sietsema, pronunciation editor of the new 10th edition of the Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. He listens to Fresh Air and other talk shows to monitor new variations in pronunciation. I guess he gets lots of new variations listening to us. Also, something peculiar. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by singer Juliana Ray. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In a new report, Amnesty International says that the U.S. government has regularly provided military aid to at least 21 countries that the organization cites as major human rights violators. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
The report says the administration and Congress have ignored a law that bars security assistance to countries which show a consistent pattern of human rights violations. According to Amnesty, this signals the U.S. government cares more about its relationship with countries than about the people who are grossly abused. What James O'Day, director of Amnesty's Washington office, calls a double standard. He says one standard is applied to friends of the U.S., another standard applied to the rest of the world. The report said the Clinton administration should seriously assess whether its security aid helps perpetuate repression. Egypt and Israel, the leading recipients of U.S. military aid, were among those cited as having deteriorating human rights records. Israel was criticized for unfair trials, deportations, and torture of Palestinians. Egypt for an exaggerated response to growing violence by Muslim extremists. Other countries listed included such longtime U.S. friends as Turkey, Guatemala, and the Philippines. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
As fighting intensifies in Bosnia, international mediator David Owen says that Europe must decide whether it can implement the Vance-Owen peace plan without the use of American forces. Owen spoke today to a group of European foreign ministers who met in Luxembourg to talk about sending more troops into Bosnia. Graham Leach reports for the BBC.
Lord Owen admitted that the past 2 weeks had seen a very serious unscrambling of the peace process, with the Washington Agreement having been perceived as an acceptance of Serb gains. But he received support from EC ministers, who asserted that there was no feasible alternative to the Owen-Vance plan. Lord Owen made clear, however, that between now and the Copenhagen summit in a fortnight's time, Europe's leaders had to ask themselves whether there was still the resolution to continue with the peace process, if, as it appeared, the United States wasn't prepared to commit ground troops. Lord Owen made little effort to disguise his impatience with American policy and said he would not be party to Bosnia being carved up between Serbs and Croats.
Graham Leach reporting from Luxembourg. Officials of the French government have backed away from their long-standing opposition to an oil seed agreement between the European Community and the United States that is vital to world trade talks. The agreement is part of a larger pact between the U.S. and the EC to cut farm subsidies. Complaints by the United States and other farm exporting nations about EC subsidies to its farmers have been at the core of more than 6 years of talks to ease world trade. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 21 points to close at 3,510. This is NPR News. In Germany, there were attacks on homes housing foreigners in four different parts of the country last night. There were no serious injuries in these attacks, which have occurred almost nightly since five Turkish women and children were killed in a firebombing more than 1 week ago. In the worst of these latest attacks, 14 people were treated for smoke inhalation. According to a police spokesman, some 80% of those responsible for nearly 2 years of violence in Germany are individuals or informal gangs, most of whom are teenagers who did not plan their assaults more than a few hours ahead of time. A new study claims that the fees banks charge their customers have skyrocketed, even as savings account interest rates have fallen. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
According to the Consumer Federation of America and the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, the average annual cost of a regular checking account stands at $184, up more than 18% from 1990. That's nearly double the rate of inflation over the same period. The study does not include accounts where fees are reduced because the depositor maintains a minimum balance, but it also says the fastest growing category of fees is those charged for automatic teller transactions. A spokesman for the Consumer Federation says the figures indicate outright price gouging by the banking industry, and that Congress should ensure that poor people can get checking accounts without high fees. But the American Bankers Association says the higher charges reflect the growing cost of banking, and that consumers can save on fees by shopping around for cheaper accounts. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Officials of the European Community have agreed to offer countries of Central and Eastern Europe new trade concessions. At the same time, the EC said these same nations will be offered EC membership when they meet certain conditions. Outlines of the plan have been agreed to and will be announced at a summit meeting later this month in Denmark. A spokesman says that he is confident that a few matters, not yet resolved, will be by the time of the summit. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Some Fresh Air listeners have made a hobby out of correcting my pronunciation, so I've decided to call in an expert. As it turns out, he monitors my pronunciation as part of his job, as he'll explain a little later. My guest Brian Sietsema is pronunciation editor of the new 10th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. He's checked the pronunciation of each of the 160,000 entries. Let's start with my pronunciation. I want to read you a postcard from a Fresh Air listener. Here we go. Could Terry Gross be taught to pronounce N-E-W-S, news, instead of news? She doesn't say foo for few or moo for a cat's cry, does she? Okay, you hear me say first the news every day. Am I wrong?
Absolutely not. In fact, you're really with the majority of American speakers on that word, I think. The news pronunciation is a more British pronunciation. In general, pronunciations with that Y before the U, as in news, are more British. Some people, in fact, overdo it trying to sound British, and so you get pronunciations like noon for noon, where there never was a Y, even in the British. So you're entirely in the right.
Okay, well, here's something else I'm criticized for by one writer, one listener in particular, and I hope he's listening now. This listener is always writing me and criticizing me for saying human instead of human, for using a Y sound instead of an H sound at the beginning of the word.
This time you're in the minority, but you're still well within your rights as an English speaker to pronounce it as human. Let me tell you whose company you're in. Carl Sagan says human instead of human, as does Noam Chomsky, Norman Cousins, Wallace Stevens, Arthur Miller, Lionel Trilling, Marlon Perkins, Fulton Sheen. So there's plenty of articulate people out there who use your pronunciation for that word as well.
I was wondering if it's a regional thing. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Is it maybe a Brooklyn type of thing to say human?
I don't think so. The citations I have in front of me from what we've got other people saying, they're not all from the New York area. Noam Chomsky, for instance, is from Philadelphia. And Wallace Stevens is from the Hartford area, I think. So I don't think it's just a New York phenomenon.
Well, let me move on with another thing that I know I'm often criticized for by listeners, and that is the way I say singer.
Oh, I've caught that myself, the way you say singer. In fact, I've got a note in the files where you pronounce it singer.
What am I doing wrong? Because I can't hear it. It sounds right to me.
Well, there are, with the NG sound in English, sometimes gets a full G consonant after it, and sometimes doesn't, according to who's saying the word. Some people pronounce the G in England, and others pronounce it England. You say singer, and most people say singer, with no hard G sound between the ng and the R. We've got citations from other people, though, who say the word as singer, and so you're not alone, once again.
It's funny, because usually my problem is dropping sounds or blurring sounds, and I guess the G, which I can do with such gusto, you're not even supposed to pronounce, or not very much.
Well, I guess most people don't. Actually, I don't find you being a person who drops sounds very much. The citations I have from you show you, for instance, giving a full four-syllable pronunciation of the word miserable. Most people would say miserable or miserable. You said miserable. Just last week, in fact, I caught you saying that.
Now, what are these citations you're referring to?
Well, my job as pronunciation editor at Merriam-Webster is to collect data on pronunciation, or data, depending on how you prefer it. And I do that by listening to the radio and to television pretty much all day long. And I'll listen to anything. I'm a promiscuous listener. I'll listen to the news, to interview shows, to commercial television, gardening shows, anything I can really get my ears on to find evidence in how people around the country are pronouncing words. Actually, Fresh Air is one of the shows I listen to the most because of the great variety of guests you have on the show, and also you give pretty full biographies of the speakers, so I have some idea where they grew up, and I put that information on the 3x5 cards that I collect pronunciations on.
Did you happen to bring any of those cards with you?
I've got a whole fistful in front of me.
Maybe you could read a couple. I'm really curious about what's in your files and also what you're listening for when you listen to how people speak.
Well, I do have an old pronunciation citation of you back in 1990 saying the word human, and I've also got one of you saying fresh air. Now, you could say fresh air or fresh air or fresh air if you were from Boston, I suppose, but you say fresh air, and that goes into our files as evidence for one pronunciation of the word air. One Brooklyn feature of your speech that I've picked up is the pronunciation of the word because, which you end with an S sound, not a Z, because.
Huh.
Other people from New York City do that as well. I've got citations from Alan Dershowitz and some other New Yorkers doing that, too.
So it's supposed to be because and not because?
It's supposed to be the way you pronounce it, whichever way that is. But we have the evidence that there are a minority of people in the country who pronounce it with a final S and not a final Z, because, not because.
Mm-hmm.
Most people say it with a final Z.
Interesting.
Other things that I've caught you pronouncing are the word prestigious, and other people say prestigious, but I think you're in the majority there.
Uh-huh.
And a word I don't hear too often, you used the phrase to sit shiva once, and that was a nice one. I didn't know how shiva was pronounced until I heard you say it. Some of your other guests, though, provide a lot of the interesting pronunciations. For instance, you had Stephen King on back, and I was curious how he pronounced the name of the creature that turns from man to wolf at the full moon. You could say werewolf or werewolf or werewolf. It turns out Stephen King, of all people, says werewolf. And I like citations like that because they're sort of from the experts on the subject.
You know, I have a feeling that a lot of our listeners are kind of upset at how you're allowing our standards to erode. But by patterning your pronunciations in the dictionary based on what people on Fresh Air say, and what people on talk shows say, I mean, they want you to uphold certain standards.
Well, what would those standards be? People give these principles for correct pronunciation, but they generally end up contradicting themselves in a short while. For instance, we're told you must pronounce both R's in the word February because they're both there in the spelling, and therefore it behooves you to pronounce them both. But when we come to the word often, then we're also counseled to not pronounce the T, even though it's in the spelling, because we don't follow the spelling blindly now. Well, those are contradictory pieces of advice, and the usage commentators in general bring those kinds of, they try to canonize their own opinions, really, with these pseudo-linguistic declarations. But in fact, the only non-arbitrary standard for the word's pronunciation in the dictionary is the common usage of educated and thoughtful speakers, and it's my job to track that.
So how many times do you have to hear a variation on a pronunciation before that variation will appear in the dictionary as an alternate pronunciation?
Well, it depends on the word. If it's an uncommon medical term, and I've got a total of 4 citations, and 2 are for one way of saying it and 2 are for another way, I'll probably put both of them in. If I've got a word where I have 50 citations, for example, then if I only have a couple citations for an obscure pronunciation, I probably won't put it in. It depends on how much evidence we have in total.
My guest is Brian Sietsema, pronunciation editor of the Merriam-Webster Collegiate Dictionary. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Brian Sietsema, an expert on English pronunciation. What have you heard recently on Fresh Air or another program that you had to jot down in your files?
Well, one thing that caught my ears on Fresh Air was when you had General Schwarzkopf on, and he pronounced the word heinous as heinous. I hadn't heard that before, but then I started listening for it, and it turns out that a number of other people pronounce the word heinous as well. Senator DeConcini from Arizona, I caught him saying that in a Senate debate back in 91. And then also Senator John McCain, also from Arizona, pronounced the word heinous. Other pronunciations I've gotten
Wait, so is heinous going to be in the dictionary now?
I haven't put heinous in because the overwhelming evidence is for heinous. And at this point, I just have to regard those pronunciations as aberrations and not as really standard pronunciations by the common educated speaker.
So what would it take for it to go from aberration to pronunciation?
I would probably want to find another half dozen more citations to balance out the great majority of citations I have for the pronunciation heinous.
Now, what about nuclear?
Now,
there's a word, if you look at the spelling, it's obviously nuclear. There's no extra U in there, as in nuclear. But a lot of people do say nuclear now.
They do, and that pronunciation is listed in the dictionary, but there's a note by it explaining that this is a stigmatized pronunciation, that it's considered by many commentators to be an incorrect pronunciation, and so people should, if they're thoughtful about it, should try to avoid that pronunciation.
Now, I might say here that there's no such stigma attached to saying the word human or news.
There most certainly is not.
Thank you. No, do people want you to vindicate them? Do you get a lot of letters like, prove I'm right in the way that I pronounce something?
Absolutely. In fact, I just got one last week. Some fellow from Los Angeles wrote in, boy, was he angry. He does not like the pronunciation of the word harassment with stress on the second syllable, harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And during the Clarence Thomas hearings, I was taking a whole bunch of citations for the different way people said the word. So, for instance, Tom Brokaw says harassment, as does Senator Patrick Leahy and Anita Hill. But a number of other people say harassment. Bill Moyers, Susan Estrich from USC, a law professor there, and Senator Nancy Kassebaum, along with some older speakers like Adlai Stevenson and Hubert Humphrey, all said harassed or harassment. And it turns out that the harassment pronunciation is the more used pronunciation in this country by about 2-1, whereas harassment is a more British pronunciation, favored in that area by about the same margin. So I couldn't help this fellow out. He wanted to see to it that the harassment pronunciation was stricken from the language. He said that I should use my influence to eradicate it, and I had to write him back saying I have no more influence than a court reporter has influence to change legal precedent. So my job is simply to record the language as it comes past my ears.
Well, I'm glad you used the word influence, because now I say influence. I've heard people saying influence.
I've heard that a few times, too. I don't recall how often I've heard that. Let me take a look and see if I put that in the dictionary this time around or not. Another one that goes back and forth like that is affluence or affluent.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, I think those are pretty much split 50-50. We've listed that one as a specially Southern pronunciation. Influence is the first pronunciation and the majority pronunciation. Listed also is the pronunciation as a Southernism, influence. And,
That's interesting, because in Philadelphia, I think I've mostly heard African-Americans using influence.
That shouldn't be a surprise, because, there's a debate in scholarly circles as to whether Black English is a separate dialect from Southern English, or whether it's really part of the larger Southern English dialect group.
That reminds me, do you get to a lot of words? Are there a lot of words that are pronounced differently by the majority of white people and the majority of African-Americans?
It's hard for me to trace that, because there are distinctions in the pronunciation of Black Americans throughout the country. We do find some, and again, I emphasize that a lot of the features that are considered to be part of Black speech are, in fact, general features of Southern speech. For instance, the pronunciation ax of the word ask, which is in the dictionary this time listed as a dialectal pronunciation. That's a general feature of certain Southern speech, and in fact, it's a very old pronunciation. If you were to look in the Oxford English Dictionary, you would find spellings from Old English indicating the pronunciation axed for the word.
Hmm. Now, do you feel proprietary about pronunciations, or are you just glad that there are a lot of different variations? You enjoy the variation?
I
ask this knowing that everybody's asking you to be the arbiter of what's right and what's wrong.
Well, I enjoy the variations. I have to admit that there are pronunciations that set my teeth on edge as well. I can't stand it, for example, when people drop the first S in the word specific, or when they drop the last S in the word asterisk. Those things drive me up the wall. But in general, I enjoy finding out that there are pronunciations out there that I wasn't aware of, and I enjoy telling people about it, and it's really a fascinating job for me. People do expect me, though, to be the Pope of pronunciation in this country, and it's just not a job that I accept.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Brian Sietsema is pronunciation editor of the new 10th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're following a number of stories, including the terrible fighting that's been going on in central Bosnia for the last 3 days. It's not just Serbs at this point. It's Muslims, Croats, Serbs, wholesale slaughter. We'll have a conversation about the murder of René Bosquet, who was the police chief during the period of the German occupation of Paris. Elizabeth Arnold is reporting on the state of Ross Perot at this moment. And we're devoting almost half an hour to a personal documentary we're calling Ghetto Life 101. Two young teenagers who live in the south side of Chicago. It's their account of their life.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says that few things are more exciting than coming upon a new artist with a fully formed sound and vision. He's found just such a new performer. Her name is Juliana Ray, and her debut album is entitled Something Peculiar. From it, here's Peach Window.
Juliana Ray may call this collection something peculiar, but it's really something pretty wonderful. This is the work of a woman who's absorbed everything from the Beatles to punk to girl group rock, and who's written a set of songs that speak to her own concerns, her own eccentricities and dreams.
I had a strange dream last night. You were there, and what an uncanny sight. You were staring into
Ray writes about real heartbreak and vivid romances. She sings with a sly throatiness that suggests a loosened-up Annie Lennox or a Carly Simon with spontaneous emotions and a sense of humor. That humor can be endearingly goofy, as it is on this loopy revenge song.
When you went on holiday, you left a trail of lies. Thinking I was blind and I would never realize. I know where you've been and who you've been with, but it really doesn't matter to me. As long as you're safe about it. I will get you
Juliana Ray started out as a New York-based actress. Her singing is anything but stagey, though. Her album was produced by Jeff Lynn from ELO and the Traveling Wilburys. Lynn's instrumentation is a little fussy, and he plays up Ray's Beatle obsession a bit too much. But Ray's talent powers past such mild reservations. Anyone who can come up with a refrain like, "We're gonna groove in ambiguity," as she does in a song called Limbo, has a real knack for pop phrase making. You say you wanna see me, but then you change your mind. You say we're meant to be, but it's the wrong time. Maybe I'm not the right girl for you, because I work too hard to believe it's true. But then I love all the crazy things you do, so I'm in limbo. I'm dancing in limbo. I ask you yes or no, you tell me maybe. I'm sinking down so low, I think I'm in Hades. Well, Dante never had it so good, 'cause if it's hell I'm in, at least it's understood. And I believe in heaven if I only could, but I'm in limbo. I know one male rock critic who said this album was nice but too poppy, which I think was code for too girly. If a man had made this album, I'm convinced it would have arrived with heaps of hype for its skill and candor. Something Peculiar is just peculiar enough to slip through the cracks, to get lost in the shuffle, and that would be terrible. Do me a favor, check this one out, okay?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He's worked with everyone from Merv Griffin to Lenny Bruce, not to mention Chet Baker, Art Pepper, Stan Kenton, Benny Goodman, Jimmy Giuffre, Frank Sinatra, and Tony Bennett. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon. That's him we're listening to from his latest album, On My Own. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.